disc jockeys were not allowed to touch turntables. At the end of a week, when I had 5 million listeners, I got the message. I think I was the highest paid disc jockey in the world for that year.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Emperor Roscoe.
I grew up a rich kid. My dad was a movie producer. I was in Hollywood. Everything you ever heard about spoiled kids was me. You know, I was a rotten, spoiled brat. So they sent me off to military school to give me some spine and whatnot. After a couple of years of that, they then thought, well, now that we've got his spine and his discipline under control, we'll send him to Switzerland and get some brain power going. After I managed to offend all the Swiss, they sent me to Paris to offend the French. And I spent a couple years in Paris, which is where I learned to speak French a little bit. At the time, I was in school, learning my ABCs, and all I wanted to do was party, which I did. I think I returned just before I was 16 years old, around. And my dad said, you want to study and become a doctor, you want to be a lawyer, you don't want to be in showbiz. You certainly don't want to be an actor.
I should like to know what making out means, and so would the class.
My dad made movies. And he would see the way actors would grovel and do all that kind of stuff. And I think he said, I don't want my son doing that. In my case, everything you didn't want me to do, I wanted to do. And so he said, I want you to be a doctor. I want you to be a lawyer. I didn't want to do any of that. He said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to the military. I knew that eventually, back in those days, we had the draft. So I thought, well, I might as well get it out of the way so then maybe I'll find out what I want to do in those 4 years. So I got shipped to Southeast Asia off Vietnam. And if you saw the movie Good Morning Vietnam, well, you know what military radio is like.
Good morning, Vietnam! Hey, this is not a test. This is rock and roll. Time to rock it from the Delta to the DMZ.
Talked myself into doing military radio. I spent every minute listening to DJs. I listened to all the best. I used to copy their technique and their notes. And I was doing my own doctorate in radio without knowing I was doing it. Well, anybody I could hear that I liked, basically, all the bus jocks and rock jocks and all that. After the military, I went to disc jockey school. And during my service, when we were stationed in San Francisco, I would hang out at KYA.
Radio KYA, these are the top news stories of the hour.
Over in Marin, the verdict is in on that obscenity trial involving Henry Miller's controversial novel, Tropic of Cancer, the jury of 8 women and 4 men finding bookseller Frank Fraschina innocent of knowingly selling obscene matter. Elsewhere, the United Nations General Assembly has voted against admitting communist China to
the... Bob Mitchell. In my eyes, they were God. I was just mesmerized, you know. So I went to DJ school because back then you had to go to school to get a license to broadcast. You could not broadcast without a license. So I thought, what the hell? And whilst I was in school, I got an offer to be a record producer in France. So I left the DJ school, went to France, failed as a producer. Later, I became better at it. But I found the best way to do it is get a good engineer, let him do the work, and you tell him what your ear tells you. But until that happened, I was doing it the hard way. And I was at Barclay Records in Paris. And Eddie Barclay said to me one day, he said, you know, you can't produce anything. I said, well, you know, just the way I am, eh? You know. He said, I want you to run my radio show. Because back in those days, you had Decca and all those labels who would buy hours on the radio stations. I guess you could say we were pre the pugger. And he said, I'm on, you know, half a dozen stations around Europe. He said, you're in charge of that now. Forget the producing of records. He said, I mean, you do know radio, right? I said, yeah, radio, I know. I'm running radio. And I said, I'm going to need a studio. So he built me one. One of the mixing rooms became the studio. I started. I said, any format? He said, you do what works. I said, well, I'm going to play one. He had enormous English and American catalogs. So I said, I'm going to play one English, one French, one English, one French. And I started cranking out these hour shows called Barclay-Rama. Barclay-Rama started going out with Le Président Roscoe. First time that Le Président Roscoe was broadcasting. I was Michael London when I was in the military. I thought Mike Pasternak didn't have a good sound to it for radio, you know. Too many syllables, I guess. I don't know. I just made it up. I mean, Roscoe, Jocko, Socko, Bosco, these were all black DJs because they did rhythm and rhyme, which was the style I liked. Then I found out that Roscoe existed already, and I didn't want to clash with him. So I became the Emperor Roscoe, but that was still later on. I was in France, I couldn't be an emperor. I had to be a président, le président Roscoe. Le plus beau, celui qui vous faut, celui qui marche sur l'eau, de face ou de dos. So you can imagine I was making these shows in a recording studio, not a radio studio. Because back in the day, disc jockeys were not allowed to touch turntables. You had to go through an engineer. I had like these four gargantuan tape recorders all spinning at the same time, and I'm playing with the mixing board and a microphone that was suspended above it. And lo and behold, people liked these paid for shows. And after a couple of months, Eddie didn't have to pay anymore. So Eddie was happy. More than covered my salary, and because they used to pay a fortune to have those things played. So I'm in the studio producing these things, and Eddie takes the tape over to Europe Number One. Back in the day, there were only three radio stations in France, all huge, all like the BBC. And Europe Number One had the dominant teenage show, Salut les copains, 4 to 7 or something. And so I ended up getting the Sunday slot on that station during that show. And that's where I lived for about a year. And bands on the weekend at the theaters. And Sam the Sham was touring. And the roadie there, the road manager, was good friends with Ronan O'Reilly of Radio Caroline. And he simply said, "Wow, you're good. You should be on Radio Caroline," which had just started. I said, I don't know what that is. He said, "You have any problem being out at sea?" I went, "Ha, ha, ha, ha." So he said, "Make me a tape." Back I went. After finished Sam the Sham, made a tape, so gave it back to him. 2 weeks later, I had a call from Ronan. "We need you on the boat." "Okay. Be there in a few weeks." So took care of business and showed up in London at Curzon Street and got taken to the ship. And that's how Radio Caroline started. I had a buzz, but not a conviction. I thought, oh, this is kind of cool. Because I hadn't been in England, so I didn't know the parameters of radio, of BBC and their lack of music. But at the end of a week, when I had 5 million listeners, I got the message.
Let me hear from the Four Seasons. Countdown sound number 21. Gonna have some fun. It's 3 after 3. Opus 17.
Oh, yeah, it's all vivid, you know. Take the tender, got out the boat, looked at the mixer board. Oh, that looks like the one we had in school. When am I on? Tomorrow. Okay. And I said, "Can I practice a little bit just to get the feel?" And they said, "Yeah." I did my little practice, and the next day I started screaming. I've been screaming ever since. And everybody seemed to like it, you know. And I was fortunate to be the only one with an American accent. So that's helped me stand out.
The sound of the Four Seasons! Opus 17 sounded mighty fine on Caroline. Carolino's happy to be back. And now if you're ready, the Emperor's got to do the thing right now. Got to spy for the FBI. It's Roscoe on the go.
From the days on Radio Caroline when Phil Solomons used to send packets of records over with The Bachelors, good God, y'all. on a rock and roll ship. They went right out the window. Of course, they didn't know it was me throwing them out the window. 4 or 5 million listeners. And then they did Caroline Nights Out when you were on shore. It's like being a rock star, you know, kids were all screaming. I thought, you know, then one could make a living doing this if one plays one's cards right, you know. So I was on the ship for about a year. Well, if you saw the movie, it wasn't like that.
Have you ever heard of pirate radio?
Like radio rock, sir.
Precisely. The drug takers and the lawbreakers and the bottom-bashing fornicators of our recently great country.
It was dingy and, you know, cuisine lacked fresh vegetables, you know, kind of salads and stuff, you know. Weather got a little rough from time to time, but all I did was concentrate on seeing how good we could be and how better we could make ourselves. I don't know about the other guys because they had British passports, but I thought, well, Christ, I'm going to go ashore here. If they don't like me, they're just going to grab my passport and throw me out. The emperor was already a star in France. I could go back there. So I had that going for me. They never looked at my passport once. Not like today, folks. Caroline was cool. When you get along with 3,000 people on an aircraft carrier, you can manage half a dozen DJs. There were no fisticuffs. I'm trying to think of the morning guy. He's dead now. Michael Ahern. Canadian fellow, I think.
Crazy sounds there from the Drifters. A thing called Memories are made of this. And the time from 259 is 22 minutes after 9. That's Caroline's summer fun time. There is somebody on the phone. Please answer.
Shoreditch, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
He was on the level of Kenny Everett. You know, these guys could really think on their feet, be fast. And my favorite DJ now would be Paul Burnett. Is kind of a lower key Michael Ahern. Does more accents. He's a very, very funny guy. But you see, I like guys for their style, so when I like one guy, it doesn't mean I dislike others less. You know, Dave Lee Travis was very good. Tony Blackburn is good, but I don't like his style particularly. I hate jokes. I'm not a joke guy. I don't know them. I don't like them. I don't want to hear them. Sorry, you know. You want to torture me? You sit me next to somebody at dinner that does nothing but jokes.
And talking about Radio Caroline, it's really great. I've been kind of going around the Essex area particularly lately, and it's great to hear so many of you saying how much you're enjoying the programs from Radio Caroline, and the fact that you say that you get loads and loads of variety in pop, and indeed, you say you love the idea of us playing pop all day out here on Caroline. You say you love tuning in, and...
Ronan had got involved with Perry Match, big, big magazine. Arnold de Contade was the number two guy there. Monsieur Prouveau was the big boss. And somehow Ronan had talked his way into converting French Radio Luxembourg to a pirate station. I know the French. And I know their culture. And there was no way they were going to change it. Not when you have... It was like going to the BBC back in the day and saying, I want the whole BBC to become Radio 1. You know, I mean, those things don't happen in real life. You know, it has to be a certain falling of the dominoes, if you will. A Ronan O'Reilly has to get involved with the biggest French newspaper, taking over one of the iconic three stations, hiring an American lunatic like me, and then saying, open checkbook, sky's the limit, make it happen. So I said, well, first of all, we have to have jingles, and the French don't know what a jingle is, so we have to go somewhere else. Flew everybody to the Holiday Inn in Dallas, spent a solid 8-9 days singing, came back to France, played these things for the boardroom, and they sat there with their mouth open going, money, they just didn't know what the hell to think, you know. I said, it's all right, this is nothing. Wait till I tell you, you have to build a studio for me. Instant decks imported from Germany, cart machines imported from Italy. They had, the station itself had some tape recorders. And we put it all together in the suite just above the entrance in the Rue Bayard, where I had a big window that I could open up, and I was just 10 feet above all the fans.
L-O-S-K-O, Roscoe!
Où c'est l'heure? Hey, yo, petit frère, va chercher la grand-mère, j'ai un disque qui doit lui plaire, ça vous avez plus?
Non, please!
Merci, messieurs. Bref de force du président Roscoe!
Well, the French unions found out about this.
Huh? Un DJ qui passe les disques? Quoi? Non, n'est pas question.
We are going on strike. So the whole frickin' country was gonna come to a halt because of little old me. All I want to do is play my own records. So, back to the drawing board. We got to figure out what to do. And we're negotiating with them and this, that, and the other. And they just didn't want to lose the position. I said, you mean if I have one guy in the studio, you're happy? And they said, I said, I'll take two, make you even happier. So we got, I said, oh, they said, oh, that's good, you know. So we went from enemies to friends overnight, hired two of their union guys who stood in the corner, drank coffee, and occasionally pushed a button. We started organizing the music. Another strike looming there. What? No French music? So we had to negotiate again. But I knew from the get-go that they were going to be greedy, so I said none. Then I gave in to 50%, and they thought they won the victory, you know. 50% English, 50% American, French. We called the show Minimax. Minimum de blah blah, maximum de music.
Quack, quack, say Minimax! Minimum de blah blah, maximum de music avec le président Roscoe, le plus beau, celui qui veut bomber ma meilleure! Charles Mondois et le conquérant s'en va!
And of course, my boss owned half the newspapers in France. I mean, it was obscene how much press I had. I mean, when I saved the news clippings, I had three crates, three box loads. We kicked off one day, we started, and never looked back. You know, it was an instant hit, the way Caroline was an instant hit in England. Country came to a standstill. You know, youthful people. The kids and the artists who made rock and roll and soul, because we concentrated on that more than the French cultural music. And we allowed them 2 minutes of sport an hour. Now, you know how these sports people are. You know, they want to talk for a whole hour on something. No, I said, in the news, you have 2 minutes. News or sport, I don't care. That's it. The rest of the time, we're playing music. So another big eruption took place. But the show got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. It never stopped growing until a couple of months later, they said, hey, we're number one. And they just spent more and more money. I mean, we had Roscoe cups, Roscoe plates, Roscoe ashtrays. They hired a train to go around the country and built a studio in the train so we could. I mean, we were doing Radio 1 clubs long before they ever dreamt of it by Radio 1. And one day, about 9 months into the show, this guy in a tweed jacket shows up. I say, I'm Derek Chinnery from Radio 1. I'm a producer. Hi, Derek. Hi, nice to meet you. He said, I wanted to watch your show. I said, have a cup of tea. Sit down and enjoy yourself. So, bam, we did our thing, screaming, yelling. Windows open, CDs are flying out the window. The kids are all screaming. The general chaos involved with the Roscoe show. And Derek Chinnery is like, with his mouth open, you know. Because they hadn't launched Radio 1. They were sending out feelers. So he said, would you like to be on Radio 1? I said, well, I'm not leaving $5,000 a week here. That's how much money I was making back then. I think I was the highest paid disc jockey in the world for that year. And he said, Derek, we'll take it on tape. I said, jolly good. I said, I'll send you a tape once a week. That was Midday Spin.
Radio 1, Emperor Roscoe.
Children, in the tropics, mix me up.
that was first played, and where the news, famous newscaster said, "And now the news in English," which I loved.
12:30 on Radio 1, the news in English.
That made more press, that one statement, than all the others put together, because it just had, it summed it up.
Summertime blues in line of 1,000 dancers. Everything's upside down, right out of sight. Scooby people, glad to have you. Wake up, music! It's the Beatles' B-side.
We need 59 minutes or 58 minutes. And I didn't even ask them how much money it was. I didn't care. It's just another mission. But it was going back into English, which was always my... I always wanted to do it in English. Well, so I'm like hoping maybe I better have a second quiver in my bow if this ever goes to hell. Really nice that Derek eventually became the big boss, you know. I'm sure he got credit for corralling that Yank. But you have to also remember, back in that year I was on tape, I was also on Luxembourg, French Radio Luxembourg, and several other stations. You couldn't escape me. And it wasn't so much me, it was the format that nobody else could do. I mean, I wasn't bad either, but I mean, I knew there would be a void in soul and rock and roll. So I thought, well, I'm going to do mostly soul and rock and roll. And then eventually I came to like reggae, so I threw reggae in the mix too.
Hey, 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 put a little reggae in your ticket there. From the boys, it's called Rumba. Jig time. 19 minutes after 12 o'clock on the sound of 247 meters in Radio 1. Let's go on Saturday, socket it to you till 1:30.
Yeah, things went to hell in France. And I never got along with the station management. I was fostered on them. They were forced to put up with me. And for that reason, I think, although they admired what we did, they hated my guts. So the riots started in France, and the strikes were national. Not just your rail strike, or a bakery strike, or a bank strike. It was an everything strike. Couldn't buy petrol. Yeah. It was like war.
Paris, the worst street fighting in the French capital since the liberation in 1944. Students and police clashed as the youngsters demonstrated against the closing of the Sorbonne University following extremist...
So it was fairly serious, but to me, 24, 25 years old, nothing. I didn't take anything seriously. Couldn't give a toss. Didn't care. And the big boss came and he said, "It's very serious, Roscoe. Very serious. You must... not excite the people. You must play classical music." Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. I said, sure, yeah, yeah. The next afternoon I went on and kicked off with Martha and the Vandellas dancing in the street for all the students. They all came storming down from upstairs, you know. "That's it. You're fired." Out. Out. And I didn't care once again. I mean, I had $1 million in the bank. Didn't care. Because it was rock and roll. It was the life. And I was given a piece of plastic. And on it, it said Diners Club card. And it was the first credit card ever. This was a gift from God. All you do is give this piece of plastic to somebody and everything's free. Now, also back then, things traveled by mail. There was none of this instant communication. So by the time I ran around Europe with this damn credit card, hitting three different countries, living the life of Riley, I managed to run up about 250 grand without knowing it. I mean, I knew in the end I would have to pay something. You just don't realize it. You don't think about it. And when that first bill came, I went, holy guacamole, this is serious stuff, you know. So I paid it. And what I didn't know was even more was coming that was slower mail. So the next one was like 50 grand. And I mean, I stopped using it. And then the next one was 25 grand. And then finally I tore this thing up and I threw it away. This is the devil incarnate, this thing. Get it out of my sight, you know. So I showed up in England, having spent my way across Europe to get there, and went to the Radio 1 and met the boss, and you'll be doing Midday Spin live. I said, fine. I came over in a Vespa 400, which is like a Messerschmitt. Those little teensy-weensy cars. Because I did everything in an unusual way. And once you get into England, things start to return to normal. And the BBC was not exactly Rubaya, if you know what I mean. So I wanted to see the studio and stuff like that. I remember putting on the headphones going, can we turn these up? And the guy said, it's Max. I said, what? I said, I can't go on the air with this. Can't hear anything. So they built me a special box with an amplifier in it. And I said, I'm not used to having an engineer, because they had the last word. I guess they could cut you off, or they had some spot masters, a couple turntables, and rotary pots, I believe. I came in, got my pile of music, gave it to the producer. Everything okay? Yeah, yeah. Aiden Day. And then I had Tim Blackmore, and ended up with Dave Price, the late and great one. Dave became a really good buddy of mine. He was diabetic long before. I didn't even know what diabetes was. Being produced meant the BBC okays the music, so I would go put the show together and just give it to them, you know. Well, I wasn't expecting them to say anything. They never did. And if it was a Radio 1 club, I'd quite happily slip over songs that I didn't think were very good. As we were selling a style, and I always carried a few rock and roll and a few soul records in case. So I basically kept going, doing my own thing, you know. And I was the first one that would play things like Je T'aime and Wet Dream. They'd be banned the following week, but, you know, the producer come in and said, I can't play that one anymore. And took them a couple weeks on Je T'aime. They didn't know what they were talking about. It was all the... Je T'aime. And Donna Summer, Love to Love You, Baby. I made sure that we got them out at least once before I knew the inevitable axe would fall. I was getting recognized because I was doing the clubs every night, you know, the top ranks, the Meccas, with the Roscoe Roadshow. So although I was on twice a week, I was all the time. I mean, they all came along with their version of the Roadshow later on, even Radio 1. But I did it first.
Mighty Black Sabbath Paranoid, and this is the first Roscoe show coming from downtown beautiful heart of London here. This is the Paris Theater, and we're kind of, lots of good people here sitting down. That's the only problem. So if you want to get up and dance, you go ahead and do so. We're going to carry on as we normally do.
Actually, the very first guy that I know of is Dave Lee Travis, who actually had a little three-channel mixer and two turntables that he would go to the local pub with, which is what gave me the idea in the first place. I'm the second, though. But I'm the first one that did the real roadshow, you know, with made-for-roadshow equipment, you know. And that was, I went to Cliff Cooper at Orange. I said, this is what you need to build for me. You build it for me, I make you famous. So by then, he was just starting with his amps. I went to Marshall Speakers, and the Sun was very enamored with what I was doing, so he built me great big hardwood double reflex things, which became the Roscoe Roadshow.
Roscoe, we pick the hits on Radio 1.
What a terrific show. I think they said, we want to get you on the air more. What do you want to do? So I wrote out a little show called Roundtable. The important part is that we never, ever tell the guests what we're playing until after they've commented on it. Because I wanted famous people to comment on other famous people, not knowing they were famous people. It seemed to be a success, as far as I know. It was still going a few years ago.
Arise, Knights of the Round Table, and greet thy sovereign majesty.
I never met anybody, so to speak. I mean, Stuart Henry was my buddy.
Radio 1.
Radio 1.
I like DLT, and that was about it. I mean, like I said, Tony Blackburn told jokes, so we didn't hang out. I won't hear any jokes. The late hippie. John I liked a lot because he was funny.
National Radio 1.
He was so droll, but I didn't like his music, so I didn't hang with him.
You've got a friend. Sound of Radio 1.
Kenny Everett kind of fascinated me because he could do things that I couldn't do, but he couldn't do things I did. So we had that kind of special relationship, you know. And neither one of us are going to acknowledge that we couldn't do what the other one.
We're your friends here on Radio 1.
But I really liked the way he would mix his things together, you know, radiophonically. Tommy Vance, of course, was the only other American within spitting range of me. And I was always kind of jealous of him because he actually had worked on an American radio station. And I've always been the maverick on odd things, but never, and to this day, I've never sat down in an American radio station. I have shows, the L.A. Connection is playing in the Midwest and whatnot.
Welcome to Insanity Prosonimus for the very last time. My guest today on the round table will be Kid Jensen, Simon Bates, Paul Gambaccini, Tony Blackburn, Tom Brown, Alan Freeman, Ed Stewart, Ann Nightingale, David Hamilton, John Peel, Paul Burnett, Jimmy Savile, Noel Edmonds, and Dave Price. Dave Price is producing the program, but his name's on the same list. It should be.
BBC and I have never, ever had a bad word. They even gave me something when I left. I'm trying to remember what it was. I think it was a watch. After 10 years of solid stuff, they threw a little party. They had a cake, and they gave me a watch. And John Peel cried. That's what I... I just thought it was a... I was so touched, but at the same time, I went, you big wuss, stop it, you know. Stop crying. It's only me. I've known you since you were, you know, on the boat. Come on. The Emperor Roscoe DJ book was done by Johnny Beerling, and he and I sat down much the way you and I are sitting down, and talked, and we got the pictures, and I said, it's got to have this in it, it's got to have that in it. I've since done another one, it's on the internet. I mean, but we didn't, I don't think we sold a lot, 37,000. To me, if you don't do a million of something, listeners, books, sales, it was just something.
Radio 1.
But don't forget, British radio was only Radio 1 or the BBC. I mean, Radio Luxembourg was Radio Luxembourg, but you couldn't hear them anyway, so it didn't really count. I was still mesmerized by Needle Time for the first 5 years of Radio 1. I was like, do you want listeners or not? But luckily, you know, Peely kind of bailed them out by doing late night stuff with these strange bands. But every now and then they try and slip something in, and I go, what is that rubbish? Needle Time! Needle Time! God, it's dreadful! Needle Time! And then one day somebody said, no more Needle Time. I went, yay. So it happened. But, so what I think of British radio, then along came Capital. They were good. I was always incredibly ticked off that they're meant to be local radio. And I'd listen to them all the way up to Birmingham on the motorway. So I thought that was very unfair. The music scene was getting less and less stellar in my eyes. You could see it in gigs. People were starting to discover punk music, and I really didn't like punk music. I could have stayed and got into punk, I guess. I didn't need to, didn't want to. So I started thinking, maybe it's time now to go back and I'll get on American radio. Maybe this time something will happen, you know. My dad wasn't well. Radio 1 wasn't saying, we'll give you the breakfast show. I didn't need the money. I mean, I wasn't rich, but I wasn't poor. Oh, I remember what it was. It was the VAT man, the VAT. The VAT came and they told me they were going to throw me in prison if I didn't pay my VAT. I was so mad. I couldn't believe it. I said, what are you talking about?
You haven't paid VAT in a year. I said, what? I said, the agency deducts it every week. Well, they're not paying it. I said, well, go see them. They got it. The guy said, and these were hard cases. Don't care. You're responsible. Okay. You want to play Roscoe games? We'll play Roscoe games. Here, here's a few quid. I'll pay you some more later. I said to the girlfriend, get us out of here. Quietly sold the house I had. Got everything packed in a big trailer. Shipped it to the U.S. That was back when the government said you can't take out more than 50 quid. You're traveling to the world, doesn't matter. You can't take out more than 50 pounds. This actually happened. 50 quid was it in cash. So we started buying up diamonds and stuffing them in Vaseline jars and 50-pound notes and rolling them up and putting in my fishing pot in the fishing reel, fishing rod handle. Grabbed my Doberman and my German Shepherd, headed for Southampton to get on the QE2. My dog trainer at the time was a former policeman, so he kind of shoved our way up into the place, you know. I was standing in line with the suitcases and the whole thing, and I'm looking at Heidi, and I said, you know, I don't like standing in line. I'm an emperor. There must have been 500 people in there, you know, all waiting to get on this great liner. Customs guys are walking up and down, eyeballing everybody. You know? I'm going, no, they couldn't possibly know I'm leaving. God, that's all I need is to be nicked and searched, even though I don't think they'd have found them unless they really went crazy. And so I'm just tapping my foot, looking at the walls, doing, you know, what, and they're walking up and down the line. And I said to Heidi, I said, why are they looking at us? They stopped and they're like staring at me. Guy comes over and he goes, you Roscoe? I said, yes. Are you Mr. Pasternak? Oh, yeah. You'll have to come with us. I thought, this is it. What a way, what an undignified exit, you know, thrown in the nick. And he took us past the line, right up to the immigration guy who was there and says, give me your passport. And he gave it to me, give me hers. Bam, bam. Said, I got to get these two on board. Give him boom, boom. He stamped it and got me into the suite. I think that was the biggest relief of my life was when that happened. And in the suite, there was a case of champagne from Dave and Mickey Most. Lord knows I played enough of their records, which was really nice. The only people that said thanks and bye.
The Roscoe Show.
Let me check out my man there. That's him there, yeah, sure is. Well, Andrew Gold on Radio Luxembourg, the voice of Europe, with the Emperor Roscoe sitting in a hot seat all the way from sunny California with the best music that's happening here in America, the music that's...
I didn't do anything for years, a couple of years. I bought a great big Chevrolet Suburban, totally kitted out, sight unseen, on the telephone. I want the biggest one, the biggest four-wheel drive. And we got in this big Suburban, drove it around, drove up through Maine and into Canada, and then back through the middle of America, and stopping and seeing people we met on the boat, getting used to the fact that you could go into areas where you'd want wine with dinner, and they say, there's no wine, there's no alcohol allowed. A couple months later, I ended up in L.A., started my new life. I was there a year, and then back on Radio 1, summer. My agent said, they want you back on Radio 1 for the summer, so. Went back to Radio 1, did 3 months of summer, did gigs, left, came back and did that for about 3 or 4 years. I'm on 25 stations now and came over to ingratiate myself into this very good company, see if I can con them into doing something along the line. You never know. As far as I know, I'm their only transatlantic voice that can do what I do, so that puts me, once again, in the niche of if it happens, it could be me. On the tombstone, I want him to say he did what the hell he wanted, and most of the time he did it well. Well, something similar to that. He will be remembered as a good man by many and a craphead by a few.